From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Attorney General Jeff Sessions says so-called sanctuary cities risk losing Department of Justice dollars.
I strongly urge our nation's states and cities and counties to consider carefully the harm they are doing to their citizens by refusing to enforce our immigration laws.
Also today, EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt announces an end to the Obama administration's ambitious greenhouse gas reduction plan.
The executive order is going to address the past administration's effort to kill jobs across this country through the Clean Power Plan.
We'll talk to the former head of the EPA under Obama. And a new Boston-based ride-hailing company on why they're marketing specifically to women.
As a woman, I feel like I have to be safe. And if I'm putting myself in that kind of situation where I'm going to pick up a drunk man and then drive somewhere that's unsafe, but that's where you make the money.
It's Radio Boston. First the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Massachusetts ratepayers already pay some of the highest electric bills in the nation, and those bills could get even more expensive. Why? Well, that's because Eversource, New England's largest utility company, is asking for a $96 million rate hike. Joining me now to explain why and the backstory behind it is Peter Shattuck. He's director of the Acadia Center's Clean Energy Initiative. Peter, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Glad to be here.
Okay, so a $96 million rate hike on already really expensive bills? Why? What's Eversource looking for?
Well, this is the first rate case that we've seen from one of the region's largest utilities, as you noted, in a couple of decades. And it does come with that pretty significant price tag, about a 10% increase, looking for that almost $100 million of extra revenue. And then on a going forward basis, about $50 million each year thereafter. And some of this is they're claiming this is left over from when they merged to create the region's largest utility. But a lot of it is just for maintaining the grid. So the focus has been on that rate of return that they're looking for. But they're also in this rate case, I think, important implications for Massachusetts' clean energy future as well.
Okay. We'll talk about that in a second, but I just want to underscore. So if this rate hike goes through, individual ratepayers could see an on average 10% increase in their bills?
Yeah, that's about right. So in the Boston area, it'd be about $8 a month, $108 a year. In Western Mass, it'd be more, about $13 a month. And there was actually an interesting piece that John Chesto had in the Globe looking at for commercial and industrial customers, it's a lot more. So he looked at a paper company that has about a $400,000 increase that they're looking at, which is creating significant concern.
Wow. Now, Attorney General Maura Healey is opposed to this rate hike. She's testified against it. And according to a press release from your group, the Acadia Center, you note that, quote, Eversource proposes other changes that exacerbate a regulatory structure that skews in favor of traditional projects over clean energy. What do you mean by that?
Well, we have to take a step back to unpack that. The way our energy system works right now is that we overbuild the entire grid, all the power plants, transmission lines, distribution lines, to meet peak demand on a handful of days when there's maximum strain on the grid. And utilities are rewarded for building infrastructure under this traditional approach. But what's changed is that we now have a number of other tools that we can use to meet energy demand. Efficiency, solar that's being deployed, grid-scale batteries that are being put on the system. But we don't see a lot of that reflected in the Eversource proposal. It's more of a traditional, we will continue to overbuild the system rather than using these new clean energy tools in an integrated way. And that's manifest in this highest in the nation return that they're looking for, 10.5% guaranteed return on equity for building infrastructure. We're seeing other jurisdictions that are looking at ways to incent utility behavior better to optimize the function of the grid. We're not seeing that so much in this proposal.
Okay, so as much as people enjoy hating on the utilities because the utilities are the ones who are sending them the bill, are you saying that state regulation is really driving basically driving us in the wrong direction here? That it's state regulation that's allowing Eversource to say we need to have this 10% increase in order to build infrastructure that the state says we need that we may not really need?
That's pretty much it. I mean, this is Eversource's proposal, so we'll see what the state's response is. But they are a regulated monopoly, which means they have to come forward with their plans, and then the regulators, our Department of Public Utilities, weighs in. And so when I was referencing the split between what's happening in some other states, we're seeing neighboring states use financial incentives, so holding up a carrot for the utilities to say, if you can optimize the system, if you can use, say, solar on a hot summer day to meet that peak summer demand instead of building more power plants, transmission lines, we're going to give you an incentive to do that. We're going to give you a reward. And so there are little snippets, little encouraging pieces in Eversource's proposal. They're proposing to put, for example, a couple of big batteries out on Martha's Vineyard so they won't have to turn on dirty diesel generators for just a couple of hot summer afternoons. But it's not yet the systematic approach that we're looking for.
Which are these neighboring states that you're pointing to?
So New York has done a lot in actually linking the financial incentive for utilities to objectives like reducing peak strain on the grid, integrating renewables, the sorts of renewables that we need to hit our climate targets, and other performance objectives. In Rhode Island, they're having basically the engineers sit down and plan the grid around local energy resources. And out in California, they're doing a lot. They've had some challenges in the last couple of years, a nuclear plant retired, a natural gas storage facility that went offline. And instead of continuing to overbuild, they're doing things like deploying solar and storage and customer-sided
Peter
resources.
Shattuck, why is this not happening in so-called progressive, visionary, tech-forward Massachusetts? Sorry, I just got really in high dudgeon there. But what you're saying, I mean, look, it's ratepayers are already paying so much here. Why are we seem to like to think that we're on the cutting edge of stuff, but it sounds like we're absolutely not.
Well, it's the challenge of putting the pieces together. So we are doing a lot independently on solar. We've got a booming market. We're the number one state for energy efficiency. The state is looking at how to create incentives for grid-scale batteries. A great piece by Bruce Gellerman recently. But what we're not doing is using those resources in an integrated fashion to avoid the need to continue overbuilding the grid.
But that would require guidance from the state, though, wouldn't it?
That would require guidance from the state. A number of states have undertaken comprehensive, what they're calling grid modernization initiatives. And Massachusetts has dabbled with this a bit over the last couple of years. So I do give credit to the state, but we're not seeing this reflected in a comprehensive way in Eversource's proposal. So now the ball is back in the state's court to say, here's what needs to change. Here's where your returns might be too high. Here's how we can do a better job.
I'm hearing you say, or not say, that if you want to make an angry phone call right now, it's not to Eversource, but to state legislators instead.
Yeah, so the state has been putting on hearings. The attorney general testified. I was at one in Boston at the end of last week and drawing some concerns about some of these components, particularly this high return that Eversource is looking for, highest in the region, probably highest in the country, for just building more poles and wires. And then we're saying on top of that, you know, we need to make these changes to enable clean energy.
We need a plan for the future. We need a more comprehensive clean energy power plan for Massachusetts for the future.
Yeah, that's essentially it. And particularly, I know you're going to get into this later in the show, but with the Trump administration pulling back on basically every major clean energy and climate policy, the ball is in, the need for leadership is at the state and regional level. And we'll see how this pans out in the rate case. But if it doesn't happen there, there are also some legislators who are taking a forward-looking perspective on things. And so whether it's commercial pressures, regulatory pressures, or legislative, these issues are going to have to be resolved.
So that 10% for poles and wires, I think it's a very potent way of putting it. You went to the public hearing, the recent one. Did you get the sense that the Department of Public Utilities, which needs to, it's the body that's going to approve this rate hike or has to approve it or has the option to approve it, let me put it specifically, is it likely? Did they seem sympathetic to Eversource's proposal?
Well, it's a listening phase, and these are complicated issues. I will certainly grant that. Getting into exactly how the grid is managed takes a lot of expertise. They are in listening mode. This is going to be a 10-month-long process where hopefully they will be kicking the tires on every single expenditure. So we'll just have to see.
Peter Shattuck, director of the Katy Center's Clean Energy Initiative, talking to us about why Eversource is seeking a 10% rate hike in Massachusetts. Peter Shattuck, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
All right, let's turn now to some breaking news this afternoon. Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced that the Department of Justice will withhold some federal grants from municipalities that do not cooperate with federal immigration detention requests.
I strongly urge our nation's states and cities and counties to consider carefully the harm they are doing to their citizens by refusing to enforce our immigration laws and to rethink these policies. Such policies make their cities and states less safe. Public safety, as well as national security, are at stake and put them at risk of losing federal dollars.
Just to be clear, Sessions is referring there to so-called sanctuary cities. He said that the DOJ will not issue future grants to cities that do not comply with federal law on sanctuary jurisdictions. Those are defined as state or local entities that restrict officials from sending or receiving a person's immigration status or information on that to federal authorities. Sessions also said that the DOJ may claw back some past grants made to cities.
We intend to use all the lawful authority we have to make sure that our state and local officials, who are so important to law enforcement, are in sync with the federal government.
Well, joining us now with some reaction is Joseph Curtatone. He's mayor of Somerville, one of the cities on the DOJ's or the Department of Homeland Security's list of cities that fall under the so-called sanctuary jurisdiction rule. Mayor Curtatone, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
So what's your reaction to Attorney General Sessions saying that that DOJ grants may be withheld from the city of Somerville?
Yeah, this is the same type of rhetoric that just is thrown out there. Again, we don't know it's for a distraction or for what purpose that we've heard from the administration, but really no lack of clarity in terms of what it means. But let me just clarify some things, and distortion or falsehoods that the Mr. Sessions has certainly exacerbated in his news conference earlier. Sanctuary cities like Somerville are not breaking any existing federal laws. Somerville does not harbor any criminals, and we are in regular communication with and cooperate in the interest of public safety with our federal agencies, including ICE. In fact, I'd submit to you, and I get, we are in full compliance, Somerville is, with Section 1373. No one who commits a violent crime, felony, or serious crime gets a free pass here in Somerville. We have offices from the Somerville Police Department assigned to ICE, the FBI, and DEA, and we work cooperatively with them and consistent with them. But what we are not going to do as a sanctuary city is violate the Constitution. We know that the Secure Communities Act failed and was discarded because it violated the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. And here, violent crime has not increased here. When I hear the Attorney General say that he and President Trump are begging us to follow the law in order not to do harm to our public safety, I would say that he and the President Trump are harming our Constitution and our American values. That's what is at threat here.
Well, Mayor Curtatone, let me just jump in here because Attorney General Sessions spoke exactly to this point today. I mean, he said it multiple times. He said that he believes that sanctuary cities are making everybody less safe, including immigrant communities. So here's a little bit more from the Attorney General.
When cities and states refuse to help enforce immigration laws, our nation is less safe. Failure to deport aliens who are convicted of criminal offenses puts whole communities at risk, especially immigrant communities in the very sanctuary jurisdictions that seek to protect the perpetrators.
Your reaction to that, Mr. Mayor?
Let me clarify. Again, this is another falsehood being perpetuated by the administration. We've heard this throughout the election. Our sanctuary status since 1987, what has happened to Somerville since then? Our crime is down 52.9%. And in the three decades since, our crime rate has dropped more than 50%. Our violent crime is down lower than the Commonwealth and national average. And we see this across the country in sanctuary communities. What sanctuary rather means is that our local police and agencies do not and will not profile our residents around immigrations and check on them. And remember, the sanctuary movement was led not only by the faith-based community, but by police who know that in order to have effective community-based policing strategies, we need everyone's engagement, including immigrants, undocumented immigrants, especially when they're the victims of crime. time. What is sad here is I don't believe Mr. Sessions understands how policing works in the modern day, in the modern era. It takes the cooperation of everyone in the community to effectuate, have a really effective community-based policing strategies. And we've seen throughout the greatest wave of undocumented immigration, all the studies have shown this, that undocumented immigrants commit far fewer crimes than citizens in this country.
Right. Mr. Mayor, so as you know, in President Donald Trump's executive order at the end of January on sanctuary cities, we had a sense that something like this was coming. There was some language in there about withholding of federal funds. Now we know, based on what Attorney General Sessions said today, that they're looking at withholding DOJ grants and possibly even clawing back some. Can you just remind us, I mean, what kind of dollar figure are we talking about? If they do this, what kind of impact could it have on Somerville?
Yeah, and if it seems vague to you and to the listeners, because it's clearly the administration and Mr. Sessions aren't unclear what the law states and what they can and can't do. But if we're talking about public safety grants, DOJ grants, our best estimate at this point, on just those grants, it's as low as $40,000 in direct grants and other pass-through grants from the Commonwealth, which we don't know if that'd even be subjected to this type of action. It would be a little over $300,000. So it's a bit of a range there, but that's because it's not clear and it's vague, just as the executive order was vague.
Mm-hmm.
And it remains to be seen. But I will tell you this. Make no mistake. Somerville will continue to be a safe city for all. And we will treat everyone in an equal and decent way. That's everyone. And if the federal government and Mr. Sessions and the president want to take this action and harm cities, what they're harming is public safety. Everyone's at risk here. But just remember this, that 10 out of the 11 most major metropolitan regions in this country have at their core a sanctuary or trust act city where more than 78 million people live. Think of the harm to our public safety as a nation and to our economy if these type of actions, not well thought out actions, misinformed actions, are allowed to take place. And make no mistake, we will not take it sitting down.
The federal government, the Trump administration, though, is beginning to ratchet up the heat on cities and states like Somerville, because last Monday, on March 20th, the Department of Homeland Security released its first of a weekly list of municipalities that they say are refusing to cooperate with federal requests to detain undocumented immigrants. Now, there are five Massachusetts cities on that list: Boston, Cambridge, Somerville, Northampton, and Amherst. Curiously, the whole state of California is not on this list, even though they have a law on the books. So I'm not quite sure how DHS is coming up with this. But nevertheless, I mean, like, Somerville has been publicly identified in a DHS document as not being in compliance. So, I mean, just what's your reaction to that? And what do you plan to do in response?
I would argue and submit we're in full compliance. But that sounds more like, I've said before, I've tweeted about this, a list of the best places to live in America. So I tell everyone, check it out, because all those cities are great. And we're not going to run away from who we are as a community. My community has spoken loud and clear, and I represent a community that believes in those core American values. And what's at stake here is a lot more than some money off a federal grant that is being held over our head like some Damocles to bring us to our knees. Let me make myself clear. Somerville will not waver. We will remain a sanctuary city. We're going to uphold the Constitution. We're going to be a welcoming city for all. And we're prepared to take this fight the long way.
Well, NPR reports today that in the current fiscal year, the Department of Justice Office of Justice Programs could grant more than $4.1 billion in these grants to cities and municipalities across the nation. So it's not an insignificant amount of money. Joseph Curtatone, Mayor of Somerville, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, there is more news out of Washington. President Donald Trump is expected to sign an executive order this week that would roll back President Obama's signature energy policy, the Clean Power Plan. Those are environmental regulations that would require a more than 30% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions from power plants by 2030. Here's how President Obama put it back in 2015.
Today, we're here to announce America's Clean Power Plan. A plan 2 years in the making, and the single most important step America has ever taken in the fight against global climate change.
Again, that was President Obama in 2015. Fast forward to this past Sunday, Scott Pruitt, the new EPA administrator, announced that the president's executive order, that's President Donald Trump's executive order, to kill the Clean Power Plan. He made that announcement on ABC's This Week.
We can be both pro-jobs and pro-environment, and the executive order is going to address the past administration's effort to kill jobs across this country through the Clean Power Plan.
Well, joining me now with some reaction is Gina McCarthy. She was the head of the EPA from 2013 to 2017 under President Obama. She's now a fellow at the Institute of Politics at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Gina McCarthy, welcome to Radio Boston.
I guess it's great to be here.
Well, you were the person in charge of the EPA when the Clean Power Plan was first, I can't even say put into effect, but finalized here. So we just heard from your successor, Scott Pruitt, there, that the administration is going to dismantle it. First of all, how quickly can the Clean Power Plan be undone?
Well, you can't undo it with a piece of paper like an executive order. It has to be a brand new rulemaking that establishes facts to support an outcome that's different than what we came to in the Clean Power Plan, which I think is based on science, on the law, huge amounts of engagement and outreach, and I think it provided the right answer for a clean energy future for this country.
Well, if it is ultimately dismantled, what would the consequences be?
Well, I think we first need to recognize that the clean energy train has left the station in the United States. We already see many states achieving standards under the Clean Power Plan that wouldn't have been required until 2022. So we have a significant opportunity here. And while it may represent a delay, I know what the law requires. It requires us to take care of carbon pollution and to reduce the health impacts associated with that. And I know that utilities are a big source. So I believe that we, in any case, will be moving forward towards renewable energy, energy efficiency. That's where the investments are. Unfortunately, you'll lose that long-term signal that that regulation could provide that will really spark continued investment and incentive and keep the U.S. in a leadership position. I cannot believe that this president, who is so bullish on America, wants to cede this whole area to another country to give them an opportunity for leadership when this is all about jobs and the economy, not just about keeping us safe and protecting national security and the health of and future of our kids. This is one big deal, Magna, and to have him simply say, I'm taking a pass on this, it's like going back to a Back to the Future movie where Biff won. You know, I don't want to live in that world.
Well, but just to repeat what Scott Pruitt said in that cut we played in the beginning here, Pruitt and the Trump administration say that we can both be pro-jobs and pro-environment, and that it was the jobs part, the coal jobs killing part of the Clean Power Plan that they wanted to remedy.
Well, I mean, I can understand them wanting to have a variety of jobs available to people, and I certainly can understand that there's difficulties in West Virginia. But you don't blind yourself to the fact that it's the market itself which is the challenge for the coal country. We have inexpensive natural gas. The Clean Power Plan
and
wasn't—
President Obama went in whole hog on natural gas.
And natural gas— being inexpensive is what has knocked coal out of the marketplace in most places. So we know that there are the market is leaning in the direction of clean energy. That's where the job growth is. If you look at solar jobs, they're escalating at 12 times the pace of the overall economy. The future isn't going to be looking back 40 or 50 years at what we used to do. It's going to be looking at the resources today and the future we need to create and how to take advantage of that.
So this is really, really important, Gina McCarthy, and I just want to dig into this a little bit more. Because, first of all, the Clean Power Plan is divided into three parts, right? We mentioned the first part, an EPA regulation that would require a 30% overall reduction in greenhouse gas emissions from power plants by 2030. And many people expected that to lead to the closing of hundreds of coal-fired power plants. There's an additional requirement that power plants built in the future would produce about half the rate of pollution, right, now produced by current systems. And some people say that effectively assured that no new coal-fired power plants would be built in the United States. And the plan assigned every state a target for reducing its emissions and required the states to come up with draft plans to achieve those goals. Now, I was looking at some analysis back in 2015, around the time that the Clean Power Plan was finalized, and many people said when they looked at those three things together, they saw that the goal of the plan overall was to just end domestic demand for coal in the United States.
Yeah.
Is that a fair analysis?
No, it really isn't. This is a plan that's looking at where the energy market is heading today. And how do we underpin that with a regulatory structure that recognizes that climate change is a danger to human health and the environment, and that there are ways in which we need every state to step up and do their fair share to make sure that that danger is eliminated as we maintain a reliable and cost-effective energy system. So the end result we anticipated was not no coal or hundreds of facilities being closed. It, in fact, was following the exact direction that the energy system was heading and where energy investment is moving. We only expected it to move by a few percentages in terms of the difference of percent that coal would provide for the energy generation in 2030 versus where we are today.
Really? I mean, with a 30% reduction from 2005 levels?
You know why? It's because each state gets to take a look at what's available to them and do it the best way possible. And there are ways in which you can continue to burn coal and still make these reductions possible. We could have been tighter. We could have made it more difficult. But we simply wanted to send a signal that over the course of the following decades, we are facing a significant challenge with climate change. And if the U.S. wants to lead, if we want to be the ones to show that clean energy matters and invest in it, you need to send a long-term signal. So we did not go further than we thought we should based on reliability and affordability. In the end, you're going to have coal in the system, natural gas in the system, and you're going to have increasing amounts of renewables. And what the Energy Information Administration is showing, the most recent data shows that the Clean Power Plan isn't tying any state's hands. It's following where the investments are heading now, and only in the later years does it control those decisions more effectively.
So we're here at this point in time in terms of the Trump administration saying that it's going to kill the Clean Power Plan for a number of reasons.
Yes.
One is that very soon after the Clean Power Plan was finalized, some 28 states and lots of private companies sued the government, saying that they believe the EPA overreached. That process isn't complete yet.
I mean, it may
be moot now if the president's executive order does go through. So there was that. There's also this giant political divide, right? We have the climate-denying wing of the GOP. But thirdly, I feel like, and it's going to come back to this thing that Scott Pruitt said, we have a nation where it seems as if there's this divide between people thinking about, does it always have to be jobs versus the environment, jobs versus the environment? And what I want to ask you is, in doing things like coming up with a climate plan, with coming up with the Clean Power Plan, did you and President Obama clearly articulate to the best of your ability to coal workers, for example, that, you know, we're going to possibly reduce the demand for coal, but here's what we're going to do next for you, right? Here's how we're going to bring you, coal miner in West Virginia, into the clean energy economy. Because I don't feel like you did. Otherwise, why would you be getting such powerful pushback
to the
Clean Power Plan and to President Obama's overall vision itself?
I don't think we should be naive and think it's happened in some natural way. I mean, there are clearly fossil fuel interests that are, pardon the pun, fueling this debate and this divide. But if you look at EPA, we've been around for 47 years. Look at the record. We didn't do anything different with this than we did with any rule. We thought about the jobs in the economy. We thought about the cost to consumers. We thought about the people who would be left behind. And so we didn't just do this rule with absolute sensitivity to its economic and job impacts, but the president also put a proposal on the table to significantly invest in coal country in looking at how we could rebuild those areas. this decline in coal country didn't start with the Clean Power Plan. It started back in the 80s, Magna. They haven't been investing in new technologies on how to do this safely and cleanly. You're not going to hear owners of mining companies say that there is a future in coal right now. They recognize it. So I think this is very much a symbolic gesture that doesn't look at the history of how EPA operates and what we do, and the fact that climate change isn't separate from the core goals of protecting air and water that they also tout they have such an interest in.
Why do you think this message, everything that you just said, why do you, I would say there's a pretty significant argument for the fact that it wasn't heard loud and clear in coal country.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's very difficult in coal country right now. I can understand them wanting to do anything to rebuild their communities, but this isn't a case of any port in a storm, Magna. You've got to be thoughtful. It's leadership in government isn't about simply going where everybody wants you to go. It is about making the case. It's about looking at science, the law, and our authorities. We didn't do this rule other than we were told to do it by Congress. We followed the law. We followed the science. That does not mean you're blind to the implications of that, but you can't let those implications stop you from doing what you're required under the law to do. But what's most important is that people actually take that next step. What Congress decided was that in order to make the Clean Power Plan look really bad and boost the argument to coal country about how EPA is after coal, they decided not to provide the support that they could have provided to build up in the economy in those areas and find out what their next venture was.
Hmm. You know, back in January of this year, we were looking at a Reuters story that quoted you, and you said that you told Reuters that one of your biggest regrets, or possibly biggest regrets, from your 4 years as being EPA administrator was not not doing away with the EPA's reputation among some as a job killer.
Yeah. Well, it's a little bit frustrating because there's no data to show that we haven't been enormously successful here. And if you look at our rules, we always gain more in benefits than we spend in costs, to the tune of $9 for every $1 we spend. But the question is, who has all the money to defend these rules? Who actually can create the discussion on the table? And I think you see a lot in the fuel industry that recognizes that their time horizon is limited, and the question is, how limited is it? And this is a market issue, not about pollution. Their time window is limited because clean energy is evolving. Many companies recognize that they're reducing their footprint. The U.S. can lead here, and this is an opportunity perhaps to buy a few more years. But at what expense?
So let me ask you more about that. I mean, you talked about you believe that President Trump might be ceding America's leadership position in terms of a clean energy future to other countries. What signal does it give to India, China, et cetera, that the United States could potentially be rolling back its greenhouse emission reduction goals? This is the key part of our contribution to the Paris Climate Accords.
Well, I think that we can certainly argue that our energy continues to transition so that reductions are happening. We're already reducing more as we reduced under the President Obama's term. We reduced more in our greenhouse gas emissions than any other developed country. So we're doing well at this point. And an executive order, again, doesn't eliminate a rule. Those rules still will be in place. What they've asked is to look at it. But I think it's a large hurdle to get from issuing an executive order to actually creating a new record on science and fact to base a differing rule. But what it is frankly, it's kind of embarrassing. Because we're not just taking away rules. We have a president who's denying climate science, which virtually every other country in the world understands and is acting on. They expect the U.S. to be a leader. Mm. They want us there. We are one of the two biggest polluters in the world in terms of carbon pollution. We're supposed to not just be doing the Clean Power Plan, but doing our fair share. And that is nowhere near where we are today.
There's one more question I really want to ask
you. All righty.
So the current administrator of the EPA, Scott Pruitt, was Attorney General of Oklahoma, and as Oklahoma AG, he was one of the AGs who led the lawsuits against the EPA and the Clean Power Plan. He's on the record as being, we looked at his own bio. Strangely, he has a LinkedIn page right now. Don't know why, but on his own LinkedIn page, he calls himself the leading advocate against the EPA's activist agenda. Scott Pruitt's own bio there. You met him once and called him polite when you met him. Honestly, how does it make you feel that Pruitt inherited your job as administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency?
Well, I think we were all prepared that there would be changes, as there normally is in a swing. But I think I'm very used to people taking that job who care about the mission of the agency and simply want to tweak it with different policy directions. And that, I understand, they have every right to do that. But what I didn't expect was that they would, you know, jump from one defeat to a terrible position to take. You know, the United States, we've seen recent work done by Yale that shows a map of what people think. 69% of the people in this country know climate is changing and actually want actions taken by EPA to reduce emissions from utilities. 69%. So I just don't understand why they can't embrace something that's been handed to them as a great opportunity to protect public health and grow the economy and to maintain the national security of this country. That's what's at stake.
Your equanimity is admirable because, I mean, what we're talking about is the undoing of years worth of work to get the United States even to this level. You're pretty balanced about
how
makes you feel.
You know, I've been doing this work for a long time, and I think we did it well. And I'm interested in making sure that if we lose ground, that there's an opportunity to catch up. And I think what this administration hasn't understood is what EPA does, how we do it, how we don't pit the environment against the economy. In fact, that's my biggest frustration, is having to keep talking about that. Because there is no way in the world that I think we would want to live in this country the way we have lived in it and grown our economy if we didn't have clean water and clean air. That's what people expect. And if they threaten that with their policies and decisions, they will hear from the people who elected them.
Well, Gina McCarthy was the head of the Environmental Protection Agency from 2013 to 2017 under the Obama administration. She's currently a fellow at the Institute of Politics at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
You too. Thanks.
Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. There's a new way to get around town. It's called Safer, spelled S-A-F-R, and it's a Boston-based ride-hailing app who says its mission is to provide safe transportation and jobs for women. Zeninjor Enwemeka is a reporter with WBUR's new business and technology team, Bostonomics, and she joins us now to tell us more about this. Hi there, Zeninjor.
Hi, Meghna.
Okay, so Safer, what exactly is it?
Okay, so Safer, it's a new ride-hailing company. It's geared towards female riders and drivers, and it launched in Boston this month. Their focus is safety. So to that end, the Safer app has a number of features that the company believes will appeal to women. So the app allows you to dial 911 or your emergency contacts or the company's call center if you run into any issues. They also do in-person meetings with all of their drivers, and they have another feature where basically when you request a ride, drivers and passengers are assigned colors and they have to verify their colors with each other before a trip can start. So the point of that is basically to make sure that people don't get in the wrong vehicle. And overall, the company believes that all of these things will appeal to women.
Well, if I remember correctly, Safer was under some scrutiny from legal experts last year when it was originally supposed to launch, because I guess lawyers were raising some concerns that the company was saying that it would initially only employ and cater to women, and that could be a basis for gender discrimination. What happened with that?
Yeah, that's right. So the company was originally called Chariot for Women, and it was supposed to launch last April, but it went through some leadership changes and some rebranding and didn't get off the ground until this month. So now the company is officially out there as Safer, and one of the things to note is that, yes, you're correct. The company did initially plan to make this service exclusive to women, but to avoid those legal issues around anti-discrimination laws. They say men can sign up too.
As drivers and users?
Yeah, as drivers and users.
Okay. But doesn't that then somewhat undermine the stated mission of the company? I mean, the idea is to be attractive to women. So if you're not guaranteed to get a female driver, or if men could be passengers, what's the point?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I spoke to Safer CEO Syed Gilani about that very thing. He says the company's focused on attracting women, so that will be the main market. But the company also doesn't and really can't discriminate. So they're branding themselves as women-focused, similar to how a makeup or beauty company might brand themselves. So here's how Safer CEO Syed Gilani put it.
We could choose our goal as a brand that we want to focus on women, like Mary Kay. They don't make men cosmetics or anything like that. If people believe in what we believe in and they believe as strongly as we believe in, welcome.
Yeah, so he's saying there, again, Safer, it's geared towards women, but that doesn't mean that men can't participate. So just like there's nothing stopping a man from using, you know, a beauty product or something that is clearly targeted and marketed to women.
Yeah, a man can buy Mary Kay if he wants.
Exactly.
Okay, so who exactly is Safer hoping will use this app?
So the company is basically aiming to create a ride-hailing option that has more women in it. So right now, there really aren't many women on the driver side of the ride-hailing industry. So at Uber, only 14% of drivers are women, and that's according to a report from Uber itself. And at Lyft, about 20% of the drivers are women, according to a recent survey. So Safer is really trying to shift the balance there. And many women I spoke to who signed up for the service say that that would make them feel more safe. So here's one driver, Marissa Lapidura.
I won't drive on weeknights because as a woman, I feel like I have to be safe and responsible. And if I'm putting myself in that kind of situation where I'm going to pick up a drunk man and then drive somewhere that's unsafe, but that's where you make the money. And that's why I love Safer, because now I can drive whenever and I feel much safer with picking up women.
Hmm. Now, Zeninjor, you mentioned Uber, which is the 50 million pound gorilla or billion dollar gorilla in the room here, because Safer is launching at a time when Uber has come under extraordinary criticism and scrutiny for, you know, internal company practices, sexual harassment issues. I mean, remind us what's been happening there.
Yeah. It's been a string of bad news for Uber. A female Uber employee, Susan Fowler-Rigetti, last month wrote about systemic sexism in the Uber workplace and sexual harassment. She wrote about this on her blog, and that prompted the company to launch an independent investigation. And then also in November, last November, a lawsuit was settled in the case of two separate incidents of women being sexually assaulted by their drivers. One of those cases was in Boston.
Hmm. Well, there also have been major labor issues with ride-hailing companies, disputes about whether or not drivers are independent contractors or if they're employees, you know, entitled to more benefits. Last spring, if I remember correctly, Uber reached an $84 million settlement in Massachusetts and California. That settlement decided that drivers are still independent contractors, but they could solicit tips and form some associations. Uber takes that as a win, but that doesn't necessarily close the door to more lawsuits against the company. So how does Safer's employee relations or how they treat their employees compare to, say, Uber or Lyft?
So Safer says that they are really looking to create a community of women. And so that's women who are drivers for their service. And so one of the ways they do that, they have mixers. They meet all of their drivers one-on-one. In terms of payment for drivers, Safer says that it's the first 1,000 drivers that sign up for the service will never have more than 10% of their ride fares taken by the company. And then after that, it will go up to around 20%.
20%. And Uber is usually around 20% that the company takes from drivers, but that can vary. So there's a lot happening with some of these other ride-hailing companies in terms of focusing on the drivers and trying to find different ways to create a sense of community or just offer something different.
Right. So typically, it's believed that, you know, the companies that are first to market in any new market are the ones that are going to dominate for a long time. That, who knows, that might be the case with ride-hailing. But I wonder, you know, is this a good time to actually be a smaller ride-hailing company that maybe there are niches that need to be filled?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think a lot of these smaller ride-hailing companies certainly think so. I mean, there's also a company called Fastin here in Boston, another Boston-based ride-hailing company, and they say that one of their focuses is on drivers, and so they charge drivers a 99-cent flat rate, which is very different than other companies that take a percentage. So here's Fastin CEO Carol Evdokov.
There is a growing number of riders who does care about their neighbor who's sharing his car with you, and it allows us to grow sustainably.
Yeah, so Fastin says they're seeing growing interest in other ride-hailing options, and he thinks it's a great thing that there are so many companies that are now jumping into this ride-hailing industry and giving customers a different option. Another thing to note, you know, Uber does say, you know, despite some of the bad headlines that we've been seeing around Uber, Uber said that it's seen record ridership recently.
Well, Zanindra Enwemeka is a reporter for WBUR's Bostonomics. You can hear her full story on the new ride-hailing company Safer. We've got a link to it at radioboston.org. Zanindra, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Wagner.
Well, one more innovation story, because there seems to be an app for just about everything these days: hailing a ride, checking the news, and soon, maybe even testing a man's sperm count at home using your smartphone. Dr. Hadi Shafi'i is an assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and Brigham and Women's Hospital, and he's working on such a technology. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, so an at-home test for sperm count, how would that work?
Yeah, so this is a very simple technology. Any lay user, without getting any kind of training, can perform the test. It involves a hardware that is basically a box that's similar to a cell phone case, which is attached to the cell phone and has like a disposable chip that is as small as a microscope slide, that you put a semen sample, small volume of semen sample on that disposable microchip, insert it to a slot that is designed on the cell phone case. Mm-hmm. And then that basically box turns the cell phone to a small microscope.
Using the camera. Okay,
got
it.
That's correct. So then we have designed a smartphone application that basically perform image analysis by taking a very short video of the sample.
And it gives you a sperm count.
Exactly.
Okay. Does it tell you how healthy the sperm are as well?
Well, it measures how many sperm do we have. It measures how fast they move around. That's called sperm motility. It measures the total number of sperm in the whole sample, mm-hmm. and also total motile sperm.
I see. And I'm also seeing that the only problems that the app had so far was that if you had more than 100 million sperm per milliliter, it couldn't count that many.
It's not actually a problem, I would say. You know, based on the first version of the technology, we observed that there is a saturation point above 100 million sperm per milliliter, but that's not necessary because, you know, the WHO threshold for sperm concentration to identify an abnormal semen sample is 15 million sperm per milliliter.
So you're fine if you're in the 100 million category.
Yes.
Okay, great. So, I mean, I feel like many women have long been familiar with over-the-counter products to measure, I wouldn't say necessarily a female fertility, but cycles, right?
That's correct. Ovulation test kits.
And ovulation test kits. And then obviously there's an entire industry built around more advanced methods of measuring a woman's fertility. Why haven't we seen that with men, when male infertility is also an equally huge problem?
That's correct. You know, when we look at actually the statistics, between 40% to 60% of the cases, men have a contribution to infertility. But it has been so much pressure on women, and it's probably related to cultural issues, stigma, and men are kind of embarrassed to go to urologists, and they have kind of an awkward experience when they go through the process. They have to provide a semen sample in these small rooms in the hospital under so much pressure. So there's so much emotion around it.
Yeah. I mean, let's be honest, for millennia, women have been blamed for infertility problems. It goes back thousands and thousands of years. When do you expect this new technology and app to be available?
Sure. So it's actually too soon to give a timeline about the product to be out in the market, but we have great resources at the Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School, too, and we're working so hard to put this product into market as soon as possible.
Price point? Do you have a sense?
It's, again, too soon to talk about the price point, but I would say that based on my vision and my experience, I'm expecting to be something below $50 when it is available in the market.
So this could make a significant difference for a lot of couples trying to conceive.
That's
$50,
correct.
And if you're saying that men are contributing 40 to 60% of the time to infertility problems, it could be a major step forward.
That's correct.
Well, Dr. Hadi Shafi'i is an assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and Brigham and Women's Hospital. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.